From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
North Oakland.
Temescal.
Alamo Square.
I live in Noe Valley.
Coming up, we'll hear how the community is coming together in the wake of Sunday's earthquake in Napa.
This got smashed. A lot of artwork smashed. Cases and shelving smashed.
Then we'll head to Santa Clara County to spend the night on a mobile hotel, a public bus.
I've heard there's a nickname for the bus. Do you know what it is?
Yeah, it's the Motel 22 or Hotel 22. That's the big one I've heard. I call it home.
And a tech workshop in San Francisco confronts homelessness.
If anyone can come up with like a solution for homelessness that involves writing some programs in C or an iPod app, then by all means email us and let us know.
Finding shelter from earthquakes to homelessness today on Cross Currents. Yesterday's 6.0 earthquake, reportedly originating along the West Napa fault line, was felt all around the Bay Area. But most of the damage was in Napa, Vallejo, and the surrounding areas. Over 150 people were admitted to the hospital, but there have been no fatalities from the quake so far. PG&E says power is back up in Napa and Sonoma counties, but 70,000 customers lost electricity right after the quake. Gas lines seem to be in good shape, but crews are still surveying the region. Around 600 people in mostly residential areas are still without water. Reporter Lila Day is in downtown Napa. What do things look like right now, Lila?
Well, the streets are all closed off, and there's still glass on the sidewalks. One bank building downtown is completely split down the side. Schools are closed today, and people are walking around in the middle of the streets. There's lots of yellow caution tape roping off a lot of buildings here that are deemed too damaged to occupy. Inspectors are on the streets right now. They're tagging buildings to determine if they're safe or not. So they're using red for unsafe, yellow for restricted, and green for inspected and cleared for occupancy. Kurt Terrez is a civil engineer doing some of these inspections, and I met with him today when he was working in downtown Napa.
We've looked at about a half a dozen residential homes thus far, and particularly the older homes are showing damage either in the red category or the yellow category.
So how extensive is the damage?
At a press conference this morning, city officials said they're going to make it really clear that they are not sure what the damage in dollar amount is. There have been some reports that it's nearly $1 billion, but they're hoping to get the number this week. Right now, the city is more focused on making sure the structures are safe.
And right now, how are people getting the help that they need?
Well, a lot of people are just coming together to help each other out. On the street today, I ran into some volunteers from Home Depot that were walking through the streets with brooms and garbage cans, and they were just trying to help local businesses clean up. I ran into Tyresha McAuliffe, who was crying on the side of the road after being asked for help.
I mean, look at it. Look how it looks. I mean, I know there's plenty of people that need help right now. And we're just going business to business, door to door, asking who can we help.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan talking with KALW reporter Lila Day, who's in the city of Napa, which was near the epicenter of yesterday's 6.0 earthquake. And what about some of the people who work in this area, Lila? How are they, and what does it mean for their work?
Well, I spoke with a couple of people who live in the area about the quake, like Cheryl Harper, who runs a co-op art gallery that donates a portion of their sales to high schools in the county here. And she was carrying things from her gallery to her car. The gallery was tagged yellow, and she needs to wait until the damage is further assessed.
Just got smashed. A lot of artwork smashed. Cases and shelving smashed. All the windows out. Cracks in the ceiling. Facade in the front. I imagine it's going to be at least 2 or 3 weeks, if not more, before we can reopen.
And aside from the business owners, there are also many who work with the harvest that live in the area. Is the harvest being affected, and what does it mean for seasonal workers?
Well, there are many people working in the harvest here. I was at a local laundromat and spoke with a couple of grape harvesters, and they said they were asked to come back to work in a day or so, but they didn't think their work would be affected. I spoke to one local grape harvester, Donaciano Avina, who works in the vineyards, and he's lived in Napa for 20 years. He told me he was afraid when the earthquake hit.
Pues yo también dije, pues, ¿qué pasó con esto?
¿Y usted piensa que el temblor va a afectar su trabajo?
No creo.
So he says in Spanish that he doesn't think the earthquake is going to affect his work. And what about the state of emergency, Lila? Do people in the city feel that things are under control now?
Well, the fire department said it received 360 calls within the first few hours of the quake. And 92 were gas-related, 50 power lines were down, and then there were lots of fires. I spoke with John Callanan, the operations chief for the Napa Fire Department, about the calls.
One of the things we are focusing on, and one of the areas of more vulnerable folks that have suffered some losses right now, are our mobile home parks. It's a combination of elderly. There are a higher Hispanic population in some of those. So those have suffered a bit more damage because they rattle and move off of their foundation. A lot of them, they're pier block foundation, many of them, and so they've fallen off. And so, of course, it is unfortunate that it's elderly and, again, maybe some lower-income groups of folks.
And many of the lower-income folks that Callanan is talking about are in communities that speak only Spanish or indigenous languages like Mixtec or Zapotec. How's the department responding?
Well, Callanan told me that the language barriers haven't been a problem in the past. There's usually someone who speaks some English on site. If not, he said, the department uses a translation number that they call, where someone's always available to translate, and it has over 20 available languages.
And FEMA's becoming involved in the disaster area as well.
Right. City officials are hoping that FEMA will come in and help set up information about loans and other services that are available for anyone who's needing help right now.
That's KALW's Lila Day reporting from the city of Napa, which was near the epicenter of yesterday's 6.0 earthquake. We'll put links to information about earthquake preparedness resources at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. In Napa and surrounding areas, many are without water or power, and others are without homes. But for some in the Bay Area, homelessness is a chronic condition. Take Santa Clara County. It has the fifth largest homeless population in the United States. County officials estimate about 18,000 people are homeless there over the course of a year. But because there just isn't enough shelter space to house them all, homeless people in the area have looked for alternatives to find a place to sleep, like in encampments in the county's network of creeks, or spending the night on what's called Hotel 22. That's the nickname for Line 22, the county's only overnight bus service. For over a decade, people have been using Line 22 at night for shelter. The Valley Transportation Authority knows that people use the bus this way. Brandy Childress is a spokesperson for the agency.
They are like any fare-paying customer. We can't discriminate on who and why they're riding. So the customers, you know, whether they have a home or not, they're riding and they're following the rules. And as long as they're doing that, we have no reason for them to be, you know, denied the services.
KALW's Isabel Angel took a ride on the 22 to meet some of the people who call it home.
I've heard there's a nickname for the bus. Do you know what it is?
Yeah, there's the Motel 22 or Hotel 22. That's the big one I've heard. I call it home.
That's Michael Garber. I'm riding the 22 bus with him and his wife.
My name is Elizabeth Garber. I've been homeless for about 8 months so far, riding the bus 22 as many times at night as we have money for.
Right now, we're on the bus somewhere between East San Jose and Palo Alto. It's 2:30 a.m. and it's raining. Some people are covered in blankets, settled way down in their seats. Others are surrounded by bags. During the day, this is a regular city bus, but at night, it makes an unofficial transformation from bus 22 to hotel 22. Dozens of people like the Garbers pay the $2 fare and use this bus as a shelter for the length of its route, a two-hour ride. So that means once every 2 hours, everybody has to get off and stand out in the cold to wait for the next bus. Back aboard, I meet Jose Diaz. He's spending tonight on Hotel 22.
I'm a homeless guy, and this is Elizabeth
from Campbell.
We just met.
I guess we're going to hang out. She says she's hanging out with me. I don't know why, but she doesn't even know me.
Diaz has been homeless for 14 years. He usually sleeps outside. The reason he's on the bus tonight?
To get out of the rain.
And nowhere else to go.
Up ahead, we come to a stop.
We can get up and go to Denny's. I got a little bit of money. We'll get some coffee. There's Denny's right there. Hey, pull the thing. We're getting out. Denny's.
Want to
go get some coffee?
Yeah, let's get some coffee.
Staying on the Hotel 22 means it's the middle of the night. The lights are on. You're surrounded by 30 or so people you hardly know, and it's loud. There's a chatter rising above the sounds of the bus, mostly from people heading home after a night out. There's also a drunk man talking loudly to whoever will listen, and a woman sharing her history of drug abuse with her seatmate. Not your typical bedroom.
And, you know, like, your stuff's not secure, you're not secure. It's just, that's like the greatest hardship of it all. It's just the constant, almost paranoid sense of vigilance you have to maintain. You know, if you have to ride this bus, you know, you've got to be prepared to, you know, defend what you've got and just really, you know, sleep with the one eye open.
Garber says he only sleeps about 3 hours a night, and that takes a toll.
Oh, yeah, I've missed interviews because I fall asleep on the bus in the morning and miss my stop. I wake up, I've missed court dates. And so, yeah, I don't know how many opportunities I've lost because of it, you know.
Garber had a job working for Walmart, but they didn't keep him on. He and his wife, Elizabeth, used to live with her mother, but they couldn't contribute enough rent after he lost his job.
We ended up on the street. And we've been doing that ever since.
They've tried to sign up for affordable housing, but nothing has panned out. That's because Santa Clara County has a 3% vacancy rate, the lowest in the country. That means finding housing is competitive for everyone. Landlords are much more likely to go for someone with a stable job history over a person coming off the streets or a bus. We're getting close to the last stop. I head to the front to talk to the driver. I ask her what she thinks of driving people who have nowhere else to go.
You know, everybody who gets on, they're getting on for a reason. Either they're going to sleep from, you know, end to end, or they're going home, or they're going to work, or it doesn't bother me. I just, you know, do my job.
So are we coming up to the end right now?
Yes.
We pull into the Palo Alto Transit Center, the end of the line. It's about 3:30 in the morning. A guard steps on. Everybody files off, some more willingly than others. Then they cross to the other side of the terminal and wait for the next bus. It's raining tonight, but summer's coming, and many of the people I talked to said they'll start sleeping outside instead of on the bus. Next winter, though, one of the county's biggest homeless shelters is set to close. That could mean even more people spending the night on Hotel 22. In Palo Alto, I'm Isabel Angel for Cross Currents.
To hear more reporting on homelessness and to get connected to local resources, visit our website, kalw.org, and click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Homelessness is an issue across the Bay Area. In San Francisco, the current tech boom and rapidly rising housing costs have in some ways divided the city. But hacker Danny O'Brien says it's not just us versus them.
One of the most shocking things I think about San Francisco and Silicon Valley for someone coming here from somewhere else is discovering that all of these, like a huge chunk of the technologists that you kind of imagine cause this problem, actually a lot of them don't have homes.
O'Brien is a member of a hackerspace called Noise Bridge. The space is run by an anarchist-leaning group of core members who see hacking as a path towards social justice. So it created a bit of a dilemma for the group when people started sleeping there. That's because Noise Bridge is not a shelter, and sleeping there is actually forbidden by the lease. And that's led the founders to ask a difficult question. How do you hack San Francisco's homelessness problem? KALW's Holly J. McDeed brings us that story.
The Noise Bridge hackerspace, located on Mission and 18th Street, looks like a garage workshop scaled up to 5,200 square feet. There's sewing kits, a laser printer, a dark room, a kitchen, and a wood shop. And off in the corner, by the 3D printers and electroencephalogram, there's Chris Zapata's sort of bed.
There's a hacker stacker with three spots, and the hacker stacker is like three just basic pods with a yoga mat and stairs for the top two levels.
It's 1 a.m. or so on a Monday morning, and Zapata is showing me around.
Can I set a disclaimer where I don't feel like I represent the space?
Yeah.
Okay. Disclaimer. I am not a member of, or have ever been a member of, the hackerspace known as Noisebridge.
This is a crucial distinction. Members make the rules at Noisebridge. They pay dues to cover the building's rent, and they decide who can use the space.
Rule number one is, be excellent. Rule number two, is, if you don't know anything, ask someone. And rule number three is, I don't know rule number three, actually. I think those are just two rules.
Zapata's still learning how Noisebridge works. He's attracted to the hacker ethos of duocracy, that action of any kind is valued and rewarded. But he's got more pressing reasons to stay at Noisebridge. He's homeless, and the mission is dangerous at night.
In my sense, in my case, it's partially a choice, to squat here or to leave to nap here sometimes.
Since Noisebridge moved to this location in 2008, there's been constant debate about people like Zapata, whether they're hackers or just crashers.
And so what we say to people is, you come here to hack, but what does hack mean?
Daniel Bryan is one of 100 or so members of the collective. About 900 other people also use the space each month. O'Brien says those people do a lot of things that technically qualify as hacking.
Trying to break into computers recreationally, but it also means doing stuff in the wood shop, and it also means playing pranks on people. And you can always kind of defend yourself by going, no, I'm just hacking this sandwich, or I'm hacking my sleep patterns or something.
It's a safe place. It's a good place. I like it.
Mark O'Neill was sleeping at Noisebridge until about a month ago when he was banned. The charge was lack of hacking, or more specifically, repeated drunken behavior, including spreading cheesecake over his face and taking his pants off in what he called an art experiment. Yet O'Neill insists that he's contributed.
I'm always working. I don't need much sleep. A bit scattered, sorry. I've been up for a while working in the new machine shop.
What class do you teach?
How to make anything. Industrial design. How to make anything out of anything.
O'Neill disagrees with the ban, but he doesn't get a say. Only members are allowed to block votes. And member Paul Manon says banning people is the only way to maintain an inclusive environment.
A lot of the regular people won't come here. A lot of women, a lot of kids won't come here because they perceive they do not have access to a safe environment.
Manon says someone like O'Neill is a nuisance, but they've had to confront more serious problems, things like thievery, assaults, drug abuse, and property damage. So they try to enforce the rules consistently, and that sometimes means kicking people out.
For instance, this morning, I happened to come to Noisebridge at 5 a.m. Just to drop off something, and I found 8 people sleeping here. Maybe 3 of them were actually, some of the usual hackers around here. The rest of them look like street people that just kind of dropped in.
Danny O'Brien acknowledges that the line between napping and sleeping can be blurry, and that it can stand in for that bigger question of who's a hacker at all.
So with 1,000 people, it's really possible to walk in and not know anyone else. And so I think that what that means is if somebody is laid out on the sofa, do you go and wake them up and go, no, you must be hacking? It's awkward.
I'm trying to do is basically I have 3 LEDs and I want to have one control line that controls all of them. So 1 volt turns 1 on, 2 volts.
During the day, Noisebridge is a nerd haven. You can't walk in without someone asking you what you hack. There's circuit hacking classes, Python classes, a Dream Team brain hacking class, and a 3D game development group. That's just on an average day. At night, people still work intently. Every sound seems to echo, as though Noisebridge were a cave. The night I met Chris Zapata, I tried sleeping at Noisebridge. Over in the kitchen, one hacker was making a smoothie, nodding distractedly as Mark O'Neill blissfully reported his day's adventures. Zapata searched through the refrigerator and grabbed some cherries. I didn't see a Noisebridge member anywhere, and every soft surface was occupied. Around 5 a.m., I scored a hacker stacker. There was a dog above me that wouldn't stop growling. The man sleeping above him was snoring. And by that time, Mark O'Neill was drunk and loud. There was no way I was getting to sleep.
Live! Live!
Danny O'Brien says most members don't think Noisebridge should have to deal with these kinds of problems, and adds that they already offer a lot to help the homeless. Anyone can subscribe to the Noisebridge jobs page. You can take a class on programming. You can use a computer. And the Noisebridge wiki page offers links to sources of food, shelter, storage, and showers.
If anyone can come up with like a solution for homelessness that involves writing some programs in C or an iPod app, then by all means email us and let us know, because we'd be right on it.
Chris Zapata knows his days at Noisebridge might be numbered.
If it comes down to that, then I wouldn't mind presenting myself to the community, because I feel that, at least the way I used it and the way I've napped here, is I've tried to be the least offensive, you could say, least offensive napping, and I don't think I snore, or I try not to smell so much.
Zapata slept in shelters before, but he was only able to get a bed twice. The other times, he had to sleep on a chair, clinging tightly to his belongings. Plus, at shelters, he's always had to be out by 5 a.m., so he says he's grateful for Noisebridge, and he tries to respect the rules.
Even if you can't exactly utilize the space as it was meant to be, that there's always still that possibility, like, it'll rub off on you eventually. And the people and the skills and the minds and the openness will rub off on you, and you will learn something to work with your hands and to work with your mind.
The hackers of Noisebridge may know how to build robots, print whistles from 3D printers, and read brainwaves. But homelessness remains a problem they haven't solved. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Since that story first aired last year, Noisebridge has undergone a transformation. The space shut down earlier this summer so members could address safety and internal issues. Finally, last week, Noisebridge held a grand reopening celebration. Only time will tell if the homeless hackers will return. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. We just heard about people who take shelter in a hacker's co-op, but some take it one step further. The housing market in the Bay Area is insane. Home prices in Oakland have recently gone through the roof, up by almost 40% in the past year. West Oakland resident Steve DiCaprio has an unusual way to find a home. For free. DiCaprio has become an expert in finding and taking over abandoned homes. And it's not as illegal as it might sound. KALW's Jeremy Dalmas paid a visit to DiCaprio's home to find out how and why he does it.
Got some guard dogs.
Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. I'm Steve.
I'm Jeremy.
Hi.
From the outside, Steve DiCaprio's house looks like a lot of homes you might see in West Oakland. It's stucco, split into two apartments, and has a chain-link fence in the front yard. His could maybe use a paint job.
This is still a work in progress.
DiCaprio is in his early 40s. By day, he has a part-time job at the California League of Conservation Voters. By night, he plays with a black metal band. but mostly he spends a lot of time on his house.
So, this is a bathroom and a bike room?
Yeah. There was a bathtub here. We took the bathtub out. Let's go upstairs. So, as you can see, all this plaster is just kind of falling off.
Part of the second floor doesn't have a ceiling. DiCaprio says the plumbing had to be replaced when a fire melted the sewer line, and the electricity and gas are off the grid.
And we actually redid all the electrical. It's all brand new, up to code, but the city...
The city wouldn't issue permits, so they can't connect to power. Because the thing is, even though DiCaprio has basically built this house back up from scratch over the past 14 years, he doesn't technically own it. At least not on paper.
They said, oh, you're a bunch of squatters. We don't issue permits to squatters.
Squatting is when you live in a building that isn't yours without asking anyone. And that's exactly what DiCaprio and his housemates are doing. But he says the law is on his side. In California, in some cases, if you squat a building long enough, it's yours.
You occupy a property for 5 years. You pay the taxes.
That's property taxes.
And then you own it.
The legal name for it is adverse possession. And don't break out the crowbar just yet. There are actually a lot more rules than just that. Like, it has to be your sole residence. And
it has to be open, notorious, you know, not sneaking in, sneaking out.
It's a confusing legal gray area. But it's worth it to DiCaprio. For him, it's partially political. He says he doesn't like having to answer to banks and corporations.
And this is the beauty of squatting, is to stop acknowledging their authority.
And it's partially practical. He says he doesn't have a lot of money and he needs a place to live. And that's how he started his squatting odyssey. Back in 2000, after he'd been touring with his band in Europe and staying in squats there, he found himself back in the Bay without a home and decided to try it here. So here's how he got into his current house. Step one, he went on a hunt around the East Bay.
Block by block, finding houses that looked abandoned.
Houses with their windows boarded up, with the utilities completely off, or maybe a tree growing through the roof, like this one did. DiCaprio says he found at least a dozen buildings like this. Step two, research.
Find out what the backstory is with each house.
He learned that the house had been empty for decades. So step three, he tried to contact the person listed as the owner. That man had been dead since 1982.
And the whole idea is that once all of our research indicated that there was nobody interested in the property, then we would...
Step four.
Enter it. And this is the first house that I entered.
But just because you're in a house doesn't mean you're home free. DiCaprio has run into problems with the police before, at a different squat, in 2004, in South Berkeley. Here's what that sounded like.
I've read the text.
Okay, that's fine, Mr. Cabrera. I know you've been cited for that in the past.
And under what...
That was a clip from a documentary film of DiCaprio tussling with a Berkeley police sergeant. The neighbors there knew he was a squatter, and they didn't like it. They said he was trespassing and kept calling the police on him. DiCaprio countered by saying...
In California, and in under most laws, you can't trespass on abandoned property. It's an oxymoron.
But the police kept kicking him out.
You know, they'd board it up, and then I'd come back with, like, a hammer, and then they'd have countersunk screws, and then I'd come back with a crowbar and a sawzall, and then they welded the storm door shut with an arc welder, and then I came back with a can of WD-40 and a Dremel with a diamond blade, and that's when they finally were just like, enough's enough, you're going to jail.
DiCaprio wouldn't give up. He hit the books, learned property law, and represented himself in court. Eventually, someone found an heir to the house's original owner, and DiCaprio was found guilty by a judge of trespassing. But even then, he continued squatting, and he continued studying.
So, yeah, there's a... Yeah, you know, I have a whole filing cabinet full of personal lawsuits.
There are documents all over his bedroom.
Probably the prudent thing would have been just to back away, but I was so... angry.
Even though he lost his Berkeley house, he's still fighting for his current one. But the last time he went to court to get it transferred to his name, the judge was not convinced. He told DiCaprio to find an heir. And he may have found one, but he didn't want to give his house away.
Because no one that was even remotely related to the person who used to own this house even knows that this house exists. Who cares about this house? Nobody but me. Nobody cares about this house except for me.
And in a way, he's right. At least according to Leslie Cleaver Wood.
Squatting is absolutely not an issue for us.
She's a member of a local neighborhood association.
I think, you know, we welcome anyone in a home that's been vacant as long as it's, again, safe and good neighbors.
Since DiCaprio started squatting, he's had to bone up on so much property law that he is on his way to passing the bar exam.
If and when I pass the bar, I would most likely be the only attorney that specializes in squatting.
And in the meantime, he's founded an organization called Land Action to help give the resources to other squatters to help them defend themselves, just like he did. DiCaprio says if he had it his way, there'd be millions of squatters all over the country. But sometimes DiCaprio made me think that for him, it almost isn't even about the building, that it's about the challenge.
I'll get this house completely, it'll be totally decked out. We'll have a hot tub in the backyard. Everything will be perfect. And I'll say, all right, let's move. Project's over. Let's leave the fruit on the vine.
Because there's always going to be another building to fix up and another judge to fight. In Oakland, I'm Jeremy Dalmas for Cross Currents.
Should squatters be allowed to move into abandoned homes? Tell us what you think. Give us a call at 415-264-7106 and leave us a message. That number again is 415-264-7106, and we'll try to play your thoughts on the air. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Jenny Butler, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daniel Moore, Ted Muldoon, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer is Sondia Dirks. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And because of your support, we can proudly say we are listener-supported local public radio. The band you're hearing now, Rupa and the April Fishes, has developed their sound from 8 years of playing around the Bay Area, including on San Francisco's F-Line trolleys. Now they're going to take their music outside. Rupa and the April Fishes will be at the UC Berkeley Botanical Garden on Thursday for the last of this summer's outdoor concerts, which are held under the shade of the Redwoods. All of that information, along with more local music and more local stories, is at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.